because we want to get started. If we could take our seats. Thanks and greetings to everybody once more. My name is Silence Makhubele. Of course, a member of the Environmental Affairs Portfolio Committee. Some of you who interacted with the committee before would know that I'm not the chairperson of the committee. I'm standing in for him, Honorable Phil Mapulane, who's the chairperson. He could not make it today. He has given his apology. Now we're going to have public hearings, which is the last leg of our public hearing process. We've done the other events around the coastal provinces in the country. We've been to George, we've been to PE, we've been to East London around Dutra. We proceeded to St. Port Johns, Port St. John's. We then proceeded to the Northern Cape in Port Nolloth, and we did go to areas around Richards Bay. Within this week, we are from Saldanha Bay. Today is the conclusion of our public hearings with all those who might not have been able to attend to those public hearings wherever we were, or who might not have interacted with the process in any way. But primarily, today is a targeted grouping of people who have particular expertise and are stakeholders in this particular process, who would interact with the bill in a different manner, from a different angle. Where we went, I may need to inform you that probably we had the stakeholders, but most of those had their own interests. Some of the issues were not necessarily related to us as the Portfolio Committee of Environmental Affairs, but the Department of Agriculture, Forestry and Fisheries. They were mostly interested in permitting issues, licenses, and many of those issues that affect them. The quotas that are given and so on, which has nothing to do necessarily with the environment. But we did listen to all those inputs and will liaise or interact with our colleagues in those portfolio committees so that we hand over the issues that they must interact with. Of course, there were those who were relevant to the bill, and we gained some valuable inputs from them. They were so enriching. Today, our expectation is that those who will participate will be focused to the bill, will be mostly relevant because some of the people are scholars in this field, are academics, represent research institutions, and so on, and therefore our expectation is as high, and I think you won't disappoint. Firstly, before we get to the agenda, which I believe you all have, or you're supposed to have, or it must be distributed just for everybody to follow what needs to come next and so on. Or I may, if some members do not have the agenda, you may need to indicate if you do not have a copy so that you are given. Yes. The first was about a welcoming address and the purpose for these public hearings. The second will be a presentation, which we normally do by the rep from the Department of Environmental Affairs. And thereafter will be a series of inputs from those invited to make submissions here today. And then perhaps take some interactions and then conclude. But our approach to these hearings is mostly that we hear you out. We don't really interact that much other than on instances where we might not have understood you properly. But it's for us to hear you out so that by the time we sit and process the bill into law, we have taken various inputs into consideration and we know what is the expectation of the public out there. So even as we interact with you minimally, you must not get worried. It's not our normal portfolio committee meetings where we grill, if I were to use that word, or you know, we interact with those who have come in a much more serious manner. Now, just to indicate that we have a few apologies. The Deputy Minister has given a formal apology. The Minister as well, the DG. I've mentioned that of the Honorable Chairperson and Honorable Mabilo, who also have got some commitment. Now, you all are welcome into this public hearing. We're going to proceed and receive an input from the departmental rep, who's the chief director, just to take us through what the bill in summary speaks to. And in no way are we saying that we have not interacted with the bill and might not have understood it, but it's just for purposes of us to be sure that the context was outlined, was given by the department itself, so that we are all focused. But obviously, if some of the issues were not necessarily touched and they are part of the bill, you will be expected to have your critique or inputs to the bill in its entirety, not necessarily on how it will have been presented. Thanks a lot. Over to you, Chief Director.
Thank you, Honorable Member, and good morning to all the Honorable Members who are here. And also, thank you so much for all the stakeholders who were able to come and give us inputs into this draft Marine Special Planning Bill. My name is Gobani Popozi. I'm from the Department of Environmental Affairs, and I'll just take you through to the rationale behind the development of the bill. There are copies which are distributed, I think, at the entrance if you want to have an in-depth look at what the bill seeks to achieve. Honorable members, if you recall, in 2009, before 2009, there was a department called the Department of Environment and Tourism, where it included the Department of Fisheries. And then through the proclamation by the President in 2009, fisheries functions were separated from environment. And that then led to us as environmental affairs to explore and have an in-depth look at how we are protecting the marine environment per se. So in that, it gave us an opportunity to see whether are we doing what we're supposed to do according to NEMA, which is the National Environmental Management Act. And we explored all domestic legislation of all the regulatory authorities which have a role to play in the South African ocean space. With that then came, we then moved over to look at all the international approaches and explore to see whether we are doing what we are supposed to do. And then through this in-depth study, we developed what we call a green paper, which is a discussion document that actually did come up to a conclusion that we have a gap in South Africa where there's no regulatory authority that looks at the aggregated impact of all the sectoral operations which are operating in the ocean space. And then with that green paper, it led to a development of the oceans policy through the National Environmental Management Act. We rather call it NEMO, which is the National Environmental Management of the Oceans Policy. And this policy looked at priorities on how we're going to look at this new coordinated approach so that we are better able to look at the impact in the environment. And then we identified in the process from green paper to white paper that these departments, for all of them, including their sectors and users, we needed to work together to be able to manage the oceans properly. And then that process led to us presenting a white paper to cabinet, which was eventually approved on the 4th of December. And in that white paper, we had about 9 strategic priorities, of which one important one was us developing a legislative framework that will encourage us to work together as the different departments and sectors. And in that white paper, the most important priority was us to have a coordinated legislative framework, and that through marine special planning, where the Minister of Water and Environmental Affairs was ordered by cabinet that the minister will, supported by key ministries and the National Planning Commission, develop an integrated approach to ocean governance, including management plans for ocean areas, environmental variables, conflicts, scenarios, trade-offs, as recommended in the white paper which we presented on the 4th of December 2013 to cabinet. And then this approach was also endorsed in the Ocean Economy Operation PAGISA, where we had the 4th lab out of the 4 labs which were identified for the 3 labs which were identified for economic growth, which is aquaculture, oil and gas, and also marine transport and manufacturing. We had the 4th lab, which is marine protection services and governance, which seeks to protect and manage the ocean environment in this new approach as delegated by cabinet. And this was then endorsed in July 2014, and through that lab, we are constantly working towards achieving the objectives of the National Environmental Management of the Oceans Policy. But one question which always comes up, slide number 2, is that why bother? I mean, South Africa has always derived its own economic benefits and the environmental issues through the terrestrial environment, but South Africa has more ocean space than land. I mean, the land is estimated to be around 1.2 million square kilometers, and the ocean space is 1.5 million square kilometers. And that gives us an opportunity for us as a developing country to start looking at what is it that we could get from the ocean and move away from the dwindling resources that we get on land. But then we have to do that in a sustainable way, protecting the marine environment and also making sure that we don't destroy what we have for the benefit of future generations. And then with the, there's also another aspect, which is the potential extension of the continental shelf, which will lead to us as a country having a lot more space than what we have today. The next slide. So this priority, which was identified in the Oceans Policy and endorsed in Ocean Economy Operation Pakistan, is marine spatial planning. And the problem that we constantly realizing in this space is that there's conflicting use of the space. For instance, in the older days, there was a lot more or less operation. There was fishing, which was dominating, but through the emerging use and the development of technology, there are other sectors which are slowly moving towards exploiting the ocean environment. And this, if not properly managed, could lead to conflicts, and these conflicts could really be detrimental to the overall development of the country as it is, as we are constantly benefiting from the marine environment. There are jobs which are derived by South Africa as a result of the fact that we have an ocean space. Other countries like Lesotho, for instance, don't have an ocean, and we are lucky in the sense that we have this ocean, but we need to have a planning system where all this conflicting use is actually looked at, and we don't have environment conflicting with fishing conflicting with mining, and all these could be as a result that we don't have a planning system currently. So this marine spatial planning is seeking to avoid those conflicts and also recommending trade-offs that will be beneficial in us as a country in continuing to exploit and manage and protect the marine environment. So the purpose of the bill, as the Honorable Member explained earlier, is for us as South Africa to move from single sector planning and permitting to integrated, coordinated planning and permitting. Because if you look currently in South Africa, we have the Department of Transport with an authority in the space. We have mining with its own authority and environment and fisheries. And there was no, in the past, no way in which all these departments were planning together. Everyone is doing his own plans, and this could lead to us having issues with spatial distribution of all these activities. So what we're proposing through the bill is that all departments consult sectors, gather information, and sit around the table to plan on how to work together in the ocean space. And this is specifically just focusing on planning through the proposals as outlined in the draft Marine Spatial Planning Bill. From the environmental side, we all know that oceans are not homogeneous. Some areas are more ecologically important than others. There are areas of high biodiversity that we as environmental affairs have to protect. There's areas of high productivity. As an example, which is highly productive is being the Benguela current system. Spawning areas, nursery areas, there's migration corridors for and stopover points for some of the species. If you look at the mammals and whales, which we do find in this space, and these have both economic benefit because there's sectors like whale watching and shark cage diving, but at the same time we also have a responsibility to protect these areas. But now there's another dimension other than the protection of the marine environment, is that some areas are more economically important than others. And for instance, if you look at the South African ocean space, there could be oil and gas deposits, sand and gravel deposits through the coastline. There's important fishing grounds which are contributing to the overall GDP of this country and also the creation of jobs that we so need as a country. There's transportation routes for transport, areas of sustained winds, and all these things do exist because we have this ocean space, and this is a potential if not properly managed, or if through an absence of a planning system, could lead to chaos if we don't have a planning system in South Africa. So this bill seeks to, amongst other things, to look at this conflicting use of the space. So when we look at the importance of marine spatial planning for South Africa, we say that currently there's no overall system to guide the development, implementation, monitoring, and refinement of national and regional marine spatial planning frameworks, sub-regional marine spatial planning management plans, and this, due to the absence of this approach, could lead to potentially leading to conflict, unsustainable use of the ocean resources, and failing to capitalize on the development opportunities. Because if we don't plan properly, we're not going to be able to achieve the goals that we have, that all South Africans must benefit from this ocean. And if we don't plan properly, we're not going to be able to protect the environment, because we will not be looking at the impacts of all these different operations in the ocean space. So this bill seeks to provide a framework, a legislative framework for us to work together as government departments in consultation with all sectors with an interest in the space. This is just using a 2006 oil and gas lease areas, where you can see that around about 20% at the time of the ocean space is mapped for potential petroleum exploration. And this was done not in consultation with other sectors. There could be potentially areas which are important for breeding. There could be habitats which we would need to protect as environment. There's so many other things which, with the proposals as listed in this map, could have been could result in conflict if through an absence of a planning system. So this is just one example of how the ocean has been used and will continue to be used. And also in the same ocean, economically, we have one traditional use, which is fishing, where approximately 800 tons of marine organisms are harvested annually through the different fisheries sectors, being deep sea trawling association, inshore fishing, small scale fishermen, and so many that do derive a livelihood from fishing, and these contribute to the GDP and creation of jobs that we so need in South Africa. So in addition, we have a further 300 species that are directly impacted as bycatch, and these are also important. So there's conflicting use, there's environment, there's fishing, there's potential oil and gas exploration, there's so many other uses of the space, and hence we would need to have a planning system to be able to look at trade-offs and also minimizing conflicts in the space. So we, as Environmental Affairs, we believe that without sufficient protection within MPAs, for instance, degradation of the ocean resources will rapidly occur, and the replacement of lost natural services carries a high economic and social cost. So we, as an example, we will propose a network of MPAs, which is a key component of marine spatial planning, that can unlock economic opportunities by creating certainty, streamlining permit processes for industry and managing conflicts. So if we don't say which areas we would want to protect as an environment, that is not going to be able to create certainty for the other sectors which also have a role to play in the space. And this network is also important to increase ecosystem resilience, maintain genetic biodiversity, and our ability to cope with and adapt to change, because things today are not going to be the same necessarily 2 years from now. So we would then have put our foot forward as environment and say, these are the areas we would need to protect habitats, these are the species we would want to protect, and these areas could be identified as a network, as we have proposed recently through the Marine Protection Services and Governance Lab, a network of marine protected areas. And this is not just proposing. For instance, in South Africa today, we only have 0.4% protection of the marine environment, and we would need to move away to a much more significant area for protection so that we continue to benefit from the marine environment. As I indicated just now, we would want to protect habitats and species and exclude activities that destroy these habitats. As an example, in the pictures in the slide, there's a lot of things that we would want to protect, coral reefs, species, and that we would have no high-risk activities, specifically in some areas which are very important as far as biodiversity are concerned. Those high-risk activities are not limited to mining. It could be fishing through deep-sea trawling association. They could deep-sea trawling and other means of exploitation in the marine environment, and we would want to protect this environment. So then with the international approaches we looked at, there's a case study that we looked at in the North Sea where a similar approach was being applied, where they looked at particularly vulnerable and valuable areas, oil and gas, sea transport, offshore wind areas, and fisheries. This is how the map would look like. And this really aided them in discussions about spatial distribution and also assisting in the decision making as far as who's going to do what. And that was really done because there was a system in place, whether being it legislative system or not, but other countries would prefer not to have legislation, but South Africa is proposing that we would have a marine special planning legislation because of our own experiences as a country, that in the absence of legislation, honorable members, people tend not to ignore things, but we are hoping that through this agreed legislation, hopefully we would be able to minimize in these conflicts and be able to contribute to the development of the country and the contribution of the ocean space as it is. So going back to the bill, how will this MSP work in South Africa? We are proposing the following, that departments, not only limited to those that are listed there, DOD, DOE, Environmental Affairs, Agriculture, Forests and Fisheries, and the Rural Development, Department of Transport, these departments, together with their experts, and experts could are not really only from government, there could be experts which are needed depending on the issue which is being discussed, will gather sector information. And this sector information would have to start from the status quo, stakeholder interests and consultation, including community interests, plans, projections, and one other thing that we have looked at as a national working group is that we would prepare draft area plans in stages and separate them in bioregions because, as I said earlier, the oceans are not the same in South Africa. Different regions are different. And also we were proposing through this bill that we would have the West Coast region, East Coast, Southeast Coast, and the Prince Edward Island. And this is basically the development of the area plans. And we are proposing through the bill that the consultation throughout this process is necessary between government, industry, which is represent the users in the space, and civil society. And I'm also actually quite glad to see quite a lot of members from these different user groups, which is government, industry, and civil society, attending this public hearing. So the process flow is proposed in the bill is that this will be knowledge-based, dependent on all sector information, data, and this will influence the broad objectives and principles of marine spatial planning. So from this framework, which is influenced by objectives and principles, we would then have marine area plans, where there will be maps, spatial and temporal data would influence these maps, and smaller planning units into the different regions as proposed in the bill. Structurally, we are proposing in the bill that the National Working Group, which represents all the different departments, which would need to consult their own stakeholders, because stakeholders in each of every department, as their own stakeholders, would recommend to the DG MSP community, which also has the constitution of the different departments as listed in there. And the final decisions as far as special planning will then be taken by the MSP Ministers Committee, which is, has the same departments that are listed in the National Working Group. So throughout this process, there's always been this question, how will this MSP work? How will this MSP interact with other sector laws? And we are proposing that the MSP has broad planning priorities, is only focusing on planning, and the individual sector departments will continue implementing their own laws, in part in line with the broad MSP planning priorities. As an example, we said there could be conflict between MPAs and mining, or MPAs and small-scale fisheries, as we are finding all over the public hearings as we are going to different regions. And these things do happen when we have a gap like planning. And this bill seeks to find a way to resolve some of these challenges. And no authorization, permits, enforcement happens at the planning level. We're just doing planning and coordination. Thank you, honorable members, and thank you to the members that attended today. Thank you, Chair.
Thanks. Thanks for that audible presentation. I take it we all heard, and we now understand that broader context, which represents what the bill is about. The good thing in this public hearing is that there's no need for translation. I think we don't need translation services, either into Afrikaans or Xhosa or something, unless if there's that indication of some people wanting translation. But I take it we all followed. Should I get that indication? We all followed. Thanks a lot for that. Now, I'm told the next presentation, we may have a slight problem of the lights as we beam or flight that presentation. And therefore, the people from IT may need to come. Yes, thanks a lot, Chief Director. May need to come and assist in making sure that they dim the lights in this particular room. Now, they're on the way. So if you don't mind, you are all invited to refreshments right at the back there. So meantime, you can be grabbing whatever you feel like, if that will be affecting that presentation. But I think in the meantime, they will be setting up so that if we can proceed whilst waiting, we could do that, I think. Our aim was to conclude this public hearing at most by 13 hours. So 12:30, 13 hours, wanted to try and conclude this whole thing. Now, some of these things will be affecting us, but I think we'll make it for that time. But you may try and set up in the meantime so that we see what impact will that have if we were to proceed without waiting for IT people to come and dim the lights. Thanks. Yeah, we can just give them some 5 minutes as you grab whatever at the back and then get seated again. So, Chilega, will you know how to put them back? Okay. All right.
One, two.
Honorable Pardon, if you're done, we could start right away. Perhaps just before we take the presentation.
They can still keep those lights on, sorry.
They can still put...
Yeah, that was perfect as they had it.
Oh, okay. Who has just put them off? No, no. Did you want them this way, Mr. Foster?
No. Just as they had it there before, it was perfect. We need some of just those backlights on.
Yeah.
As they had it, sorry.
It mustn't completely be dark. Is it fine?
That looks fine, thank you.
Okay.
Thanks very much.
Thanks, it's okay. Thanks, sir. Yes, the presentation now will be given by Mr. Craig Foster, representing Sea Change Project. So let's go ahead, sir.
Honorable Chairperson, honorable committee members, thank you so much. I'm very privileged to have this opportunity to be here in Parliament talking to you. I've had this extraordinary experience of late to have spent a year living with an octopus, visiting a wild octopus every single day for a year and building up this incredible relationship with this animal. So I think we are breaking some kind of strange record, because I want to bring that octopus's wisdom into this Parliament today and get you a sense of the incredible, how incredible this animal is and what, how much we can learn from this animal. And I want to connect that to, I think, two things that are very important for this bill: the precautionary principle and the ecological foundation. I am part of the Sea Change Project. I'm the founder, and we specialize in bringing indigenous knowledge and science and translating that into conservation media. This project, which I'm calling the Octopus Teacher, is predicted to go to out to 1 billion people globally in the form of a film, a book, exhibition, and we're well into that project. I've been privileged to be mentored and taught over a period of 20 years by an incredible group of indigenous people from all over Africa and Central America, San Bushmen, master trackers, crocodile shamans, etc., etc. I've also been very lucky to have a credible group of scientists that I work with the whole time, and some of the top journalists in the world. So we've got an incredible team behind this whole project. My key mentor on land in the marine environment is Professor Charles Griffiths, who has himself discovered over 100 new species, and I spend every low tide with him in this environment, learning from this, what I call the Grand Master. But this is my primary teacher in the water. This is the superstar. I call her the superstar. She's a liquid magician, and she has been my greatest inspiration, actually, in my life in terms of learning about nature. Just to give you some sense of where we sit in evolutionary terms compared to octopus, if we had to compress evolutionary time down to 1,000 days, we'd be living for 1 day and the octopus would be living for 1,000 days. So they've been around a lot longer than us. What is incredible about this coast that we're talking about here, what is absolutely incredible, is the latest genetic evidence seems to be pointing to this area as the very origin of our species. And I've had incredible scientists and the latest papers pointing more and more strongly to this. But what is even more incredible is that if you think about what this coast used to look like, we're talking about black marlin in the rock pools. We're talking about fish so thick that you could walk on top of the water. You're talking about springbok migrations coming down to the water in excess of 50 million animals, 250,000 animals being pushed. Imagine this beach here, 250,000 animals pushed into the water, and they'd be drowning and being eaten by sharks. So we had a bounty here that is hard for us to even imagine. The other almost more important thing than the origin of the species is we have incredibly powerful evidence to show that this area in southern Africa, this coast, is where the human mind woke up. This is where human beings first became symbolic. So it's literally here on these shores of Eden where we became a human in the mind. It's called the cradle of the human mind. And I'll explain to you why this is so. What we have here, this is a recreation, and these are recreations I've done for the top human origin series at the moment. This is a recreation of this incredible artifact. And this is one of the oldest pieces of abstract art in the world, found at Blombos Cave just up the coast here. What we have here is a collection of the oldest abstract art on Earth. Now, this is it's a very, very powerful thing because these people were the first people, these African people living on this coast were the first people ever to create art. And in fact, what they were creating were the first computers and the first books. Because when you take something outside the human brain and you put it onto something else, that's what you're doing. You're storing information. So they stored information. Some of these pieces are 100,000 years old. Oldest art on Earth, and we can still see them and get interpretations today. So this is the Mecca. We are sitting here in this Mecca. There's no other place on Earth that even comes close. And so few people realize this. This is the incredible scientific team I'm working with from South Africa and from all over the world and have incredible evidence that backs this up. The key person is Professor Chris Henschelwood, who's arguably Africa's top archaeologist, and he has spent 30 years writing papers and doing work on this, and I'm working closely with him. What we have here is perhaps one of the most incredible things ever found in archaeology in the history of the world. This is the oldest chemistry kit on Earth. It's an abalone shell with this incredible mixture, and it was found again just up the coast here. So this is the oldest science on Earth, created by Africans 100,000 years ago. Unprecedented. There's nowhere else on Earth that has anything close. And this is what they were doing. They were mixing these complex ingredients into some type of ritual paint in an abalone shell and then using it perhaps for ritual purposes. This is one of the oldest spears or a collection of the oldest spears, some of the most sophisticated stone tools on our planet. So what we have, this is also a collection of stone tools that make up the oldest bow and arrows on Earth. This is slightly later, 65,000, but that completely changed our relationship to hunting. So this is all happening here on the South African coast, which makes it, as I say, unprecedented anywhere in the world in terms of relationship with an environment. Absolutely remarkable. What is so interesting is that, you know, a short period of time ago, if you'd spoken to any of the top paleoscientists, they would have said that Europe was the seat of art and science. Now it is absolutely firmly in place that Africa is the absolute origin of all art and all science and human consciousness as we know it. So this whole Eurocentric idea of them being more advanced and so on gets absolutely smashed on the head by this incredible evidence. And all these things were then taken out of Africa. We incubated in Africa for hundreds of thousands of years. We awoke at 100,000. And only at 60,000 years ago did we move out of Africa and take all this incredible art and science to the rest of the world. Pippa, sorry, could you just move slightly? I need to see that there. So we have this incredible pride in our coast that comes from this incredible origin, this ancient lineage that is, you must remember that the DNA shows that every single human being on Earth has their origin here in South Africa on this coast. This is what we're implying. So it's quite the most remarkable place. Now, when did the first humans encounter octopus? We've got very interesting evidence in the caves to suggest that about 90,000 years, these people started taking to the water and actually diving in that environment. And that's when they'd have first seen this animal underwater. So we recreated this scene of these first human divers to mark this very momentous time. The first human swimmers, the first human divers, the first, you know, relationship with the ocean in that full capacity. And we reckon they climbed down on the kelp stipes. And this is what they were after, abalone, this incredible food that we know well today. And they were also after these Turbo somaticus, the olecrical. And we find those in large abundance in the caves, indicating that that's what they were doing. So with this incredible backdrop and this knowledge, I started to dive myself, taking my son and teaching him like this, just as my father taught me. I started diving when I was 3 years old. And I set myself this task for 10 years to dive every single day, 365 days a year, so I could connect with this environment. And the first challenge was the cold. I wanted to dive like my ancestors had, deep ancestors, so no wetsuits, just a hoodie because it's to protect the ears from the cold. So I struggled. It was a huge struggle. For a year, it was a massive struggle, shivering, freezing every day, and then slowly my body adapted, and I built up the brown fat reserves that our ancestors would have had, and now it's easy to go in for up to 2 hours in the coldest water here, no problem. The wonderful thing is the whole hormonal system, your whole immune system just turns on. The amount of health and vitality that this gives is absolutely remarkable. So then the next challenge was, how could I get in touch with this environment? How could I connect with it? And I've spent, as I said, years hunting with these incredible masters in the central Kalahari. So I took the knowledge they'd taught me, and I took that into the marine environment. And it took about 2 years to learn to track underwater using these amazing fine tracks left by mollusks and a whole lot of other clues. I was able to eventually track these animals underwater and learn things that no scientist had ever seen before. This is just to give you a simple example. These are the mollusk tracks on this giant stingray. It's 4.5-meter giant stingray, and you can tell by how the mollusk have been moving on its body, what it's been doing, how long it's been there, etc., etc. This is a striped cat shark, and again, a mollusk track leaving the slime trail over its head allows you to tell how long this animal's been sleeping, what it's been doing. So you can look backwards and forwards in time by these cryptic marks that we find all over the underwater environment. I don't know if anybody can see this animal. This is the octopus using its camouflage to blend into this shelly bed. It's in the middle, slightly to the top, and it's matching in color in every way. So octopus are very difficult to track because they're so hard to see. So what I use is their kills. They love to eat abalone, and they make a tiny hole in the abalone shell, and they inject a venom in there to paralyze it. Now, that little hole, shining light in the middle, that's the hole. That's the tiny little oval hole. So I'm using these tiny holes to predict which shells have been eaten by octopus and how to follow them from den to den. And that's how I followed the superstar and kept up with her for a year. And then what that taught me was that there's all these signs everywhere, these incredibly small marks that show you exactly what's going on. The bottom middle one, for instance, is the tooth marks made by limpets, so you can see where they've been feeding, and these are all other little marks. This is a superstar octopus when she was young, very, very timid, reaching out to me with her limb still hiding under that abalone shell, very unsure of herself. And it's just day after day after day visiting her. And eventually, after a few months, she was able to hunt right in front of me. I went on these incredible hunting journeys with this animal in the underwater environment. Here she's hunting lobster, and she completely ignores me and sometimes even uses me as a foil against the animal she's trying to catch. So here she's sneaking up on this lobster and uses this incredible technique where she throws her hood right over the top like that. Because the lobsters are very fast and catches them in that way. And she can catch three or four at a time before she takes them back to her den. Eventually, this animal was so tame, it used to come up to my son, myself, and interact with us. We never made contact with it, but it used to love to interact with us, completely trusting a highly, highly intelligent animal. Then, you know, to our horror, as we got to know this animal better, we saw the main predators, and these are these striped cat sharks, attacking this animal, and, you know, had absolute sleepless nights about this. But what is incredible is that she escaped. And you could see she's lost her limb there, and we were terribly worried. But she really is a magician. She's a master. She's a superstar. And in 2 months, you can see the limb growing back there. They regrow their limbs right back to perfectly normal. There you can see it growing further and then fully grown back. So these animals are absolutely incredible in that way. She then eventually allowed me to take my little camera and put it inside her den. Normally they won't allow that, but she was quite comfortable with that. And what was extraordinary is I found other animals living inside that den. And if you can see carefully here, there's that little, she's caught a crab, but just above her eye is a shoal of little mithid shrimps. And this is what they look like. I'd never seen these before, so I took these back to my master teacher on land, Professor Griffiths, and this turned out to be a new species to science. And we went on to go work with him, and we found many, many, many new species and over 30 or actually 35 now completely new behaviors, animal behaviors to science. So then Charles took these behaviors. This is just one of the examples of this helmet shell that predates on these animals in a special way. And we have master students now working on all these projects. This is Tando working on her project. This is the PhD student working on another project. We've discovered a new species of mollusk all through this octopus and through the underwater tracking. What was incredible then is that I, you know, just working here quietly on the end of the earth, and the next minute, word got out about the superstar, and BBC Blue Planet arrived. BBC Blue Planet, I'm sure you know who they are. It's the biggest marine show on Earth, narrated by David Attenborough. And this is Roger Horrocks, who's the top cinematographer in the world, in my mind. And he and the whole team came, and they filmed one of the big sequences for the film, including a making of, so we prominent one of their big programs going out in October next month to 188 countries. So the superstar really is becoming a world superstar now. And she loved the attention to some degree of the big cameras. This is just some of the crew. We've got underwater directors. It was a crazy scenario working with the best tech on the planet. So it was all going very well, and then along came the octopus fishery. And for me, it was fairly scary, of course. I made this connection with these animals, and the next minute, we had hundreds of these plastic octopus traps everywhere, and the octopus getting caught in the traps. So it was, you can imagine, you connect with this animal, they almost become like family, so it's devastating, but you also, you know, have to be open-minded and understand that perhaps octopus are very fast-growing animals, and you know, would they survive this? How would they do? So I tried to keep an open mind, even though it was very sad for me. I did notice that, you know, the single octopus, in my calculation, generated more income than 20,000 dead octopus in the traps. They catch 30 tons a year out of false bay alone. My son noticed and what I noticed was the cat sharks started to leave the area because the octopus numbers dropped substantially. So we had a lot of these are now on the threatened list. These animals moved out of the area. There used to be five or six in the cave where we work, and there are mostly none now. These sharks and most of the small sharks mature very, very slowly. These sharks are 35 years old. That's how old they get. This is the little egg where they grow in, and these eggs hardly ever make it to hatching. This is one hatching that we did get, but they mostly get eaten by mollusks. The otters rely on the octopus for food, one of their favorite foods. The bigger sharks, the spotted gully sharks, rely on the octopus. So what we started to see was the predators were starting to lose their food. And if a predator, if predators move out of the environment, then you've got a serious problem, a really serious problem. They are absolutely critical to the health of the environment. I'm sure you guys know that. But down from the octopus, these are the serpentine brittle stars. And the octopus are very messy eaters. So all the animals in the lower food chains, the invertebrates, rely on the octopus, and they hang around the octopus den, and they require a lot of their food. So we saw that is becoming a big problem as well. Then many of the whales in the area started to get caught in the octopus traps, in the crayfish traps, and in the whelk traps. Now, as I'm sure you know, one of the greatest conservation miracles on Earth has been the whales coming back to our area. So it seemed to me extraordinary that we would have a system that would be catching these animals and killing them in fairly large numbers and entangling them, and that would carry on without at least that system being changed or something being done about it. It just seemed crazy, but it seems to continue. So what I'm getting at here is that initially, if you look just at an octopus, they breed very fast. They come back. They breed in large numbers. So it seems maybe viable that you could use them as a fishery. But what we're not seeing is this massive ecosystem around it. As we pull on that one string, thousands of other strings get pulled, and that's the concern here. There's no scientific evidence to show that we should be able to take these animals. There's exploratory license that's just been rolled over for 15 years now, so that brings up a lot of questions for me why that's happening. My sense is that when we are making decisions about the ocean, that this ecosystem approach, where you look at the whole ecosystem, would be a great thing to possibly look at instead of just looking at one species. Like the octopus's favorite food, the abalone, as we mentioned, we see the poaching now. I mean, I see it so regularly. We're seeing the dead animals in the shells in the water everywhere. It seems like that is just out of control. So that's also a big worry for me. I've seen how brave a lot of these rangers are, but it's overwhelming, and I wonder why something is not being done about it in a bigger way. This is a wonderful man, Donovan van der Heijden, who actually helped tremendously with the recreation process. He's very proud of his heritage, and that's he's helped me to recreate this whole ancient human family. And what he's done is take these images and take his involvement in that and take it back to the youngsters in his fishing township. He's a traditional fisher, and he's getting affected very much by all this poaching and so on, and it's obviously, as you know, associated with the drugs, and he's trying to take this pride and get the kids interested in this sort of thing and to get away from the drugs and all that violence associated with the poaching, and he wants to get back to traditional fishing. It's just one example of that, and to develop this incredible pride in these early humans who nurtured this coast in an amazing way. Obviously, there are smaller numbers of them. The other obviously big issue, another favorite octopus food, the crayfish. I'm sure you know they're down to less than 2% of their original numbers, yet we keep harvesting them. So we are actually, you know, hugely threatening the jobs and food security in this sector for the future, because this population is about to collapse. Why would you do that? You should surely think about giving them a chance to recover, and then we can really harvest them properly. So what I'm trying to say, and what I've learned from this octopus, is that humans and nature are inseparable. We actually always were connected, and we still are. And this you can see in the incredible rock paintings all over South Africa. I don't know if you can see these lines connecting the main human in the middle to all these figures, actually shows that. And these early humans knew this extremely well. This is another thing that's always fascinated me and is part of this process, this primal joy, this wilderness rapture that comes from being in nature. And these early humans, it's been widely studied, had this. And I think we have the opportunity as South Africans, if we have this environment which we look after, to experience this on a very deep level. So what we're seeing in other parts of the world is something called nature deficit disorder, which you may be familiar with. People, especially in America and Europe, children are suffering at a deep level from this disorder, from being disconnected from nature. And we're so lucky in South Africa to have these incredible spaces available, because they simply don't have that. And you're starting to see this as a major problem, causing massive widespread depression and anxiety, especially in youngsters. So my sense is that, and everybody knows this, but it's brought home so hard to me when I'm being in the water every day, that all our political, social, economic issues sit firmly on the ecological foundation. Everything we do is related to that. And if we keep chipping away at that foundation, which we surely are doing that, it's everybody, I blame myself just as much, that we will bring everything down, and all our other issues are going to become insignificant in comparison when that happens. I mean, we are in the sixth great mass extinction event at the moment, and it's a serious, serious thing going on. As you know, the oxygen supply that we have, if we take three breaths now, two of those will be provided by the ocean. If we start taking out our predators and we start messing with our ecosystem, this could be a problem. Already in places like India, we have 40% of the children with irreparable lung damage in the cities. So it's a real thing. It really is a real thing. We have in the ancestral population at times we had 99% protection of the ocean. As we heard earlier in the other presentation, we've only have now 0.4%. So we desperately need to get that up to at least 10% for the time being. The good news is that South Africa is still partly intact. We've still got an incredible ecosystem. We still have a mega diverse country, very rare country in the world. So we've got the opportunity now to protect something that is completely invaluable and comparable with the best ecosystems in the world. The precautionary principle, which I'm sure you're familiar with, really got brought home to me with my experience with the octopus, in that we have to be, when we make decisions about nature, we have to err on the side of precaution. Really, because especially if we don't understand the full scientific story, which is often the case, a lot of decisions are being made without deep science, and then we should err on the side of precaution, otherwise we're going to be in serious trouble. We have a 300,000-year unbroken relationship with this environment. And I can sense those early ancestors looking at us and wondering, what are we doing? You know, and I feel that we have an obligation to them to really look after this place. I have this opportunity, as I say, to go out to this massive audience and to show this value of deep nature, and I will be doing everything I can to promote South Africa and this incredible space, and I really feel very privileged to speak in front of you people and to be able to take that forward. This is the last slide, and I'd just like to leave you with this idea that this is the superstar in her den, and she only lives for a year and a half, And then she sacrifices her life for her children. She looks after her eggs, and she stops eating, and she could live for longer, but she doesn't. She sacrifices for her children. And I saw her die, and I saw her get eaten by fish and taken by the cat shark mercifully. And this is just her eye looking at us, and, you know, she's dying for her children. I'm not saying we should die for our children, but we should at least leave a legacy, something for our children, and an ocean that can bring that primal joy through, that can bring that incredible sense of love for nature that they so desperately need. Thank you so much. Greatly appreciate it.
Thanks. Thanks, Mr. Foster. Of course, it was an angle of its own, much useful for us to understand why decisions should be taken whilst being exercising some caution. So that we don't mess up with the ocean, we don't mess up with the environment, and so on. Thanks for that. All right. Members, do we need to interact with that info? We're fine. Honorable Edwards and Honorable Nyambi? Yes.
Thank you, Chairperson. And thank you very much for the presentation. It was very much informing. Chairperson, what specific aspect of the bill would he like change or further amendment according to his presentation? Thank you, Chair.
Do you have another question? Not. Okay. Yes, you may take care.
Sorry, would you mind just repeating that question?
Chairperson, I just want to say, according to his presentation, I want to know what specific aspects of the bill would you like change or further amendment according to your presentation?
Thank you. I think that one of the most important things are clearly the marine protected areas. That is obviously a critical thing that I would very much like looked at in depth, and that percentage of ocean to be protected in the highest percentage absolutely possible. I would clearly like, the crayfish fishery to be looked at, because we're down to less than 2% of those animals, and this certainly the octopus fishery as well. Why are we catching so many whales? Why haven't we got proper science in place? Is it really viable to take out these octopus when we are seeing so much devastation in the rest of the environment?
Well, thanks. I think it's understood. Thanks a lot. Okay. Members, perhaps without... let's proceed to Mr. S. Rowe, Center for Environmental Rights and WWF. Okay, you may set up, sir.
Thank you, Honourable Chair, and thank you, Honourable Committee members. I'm just going to outline the Centre for Environmental Rights comment on the MSP bill. But first, I just want to say that we've looked at the number of iterations that this bill has been through, and I think that the Department of Environmental Affairs should be commended for really engaging in this process. It's and you can see the refinements that go through each iterations. And I just want to also add, I mean, one of our major comments in the first bill was the importance of an ecosystem-based approach to marine spatial planning. I mean, I think that very much underpins the international experience of what MSP is intended to achieve, and also a proper principles framework. So what principles guide decision-making? And in the initial iterations, those principles weren't there. And then in this latest iteration of the bill, there's a very firm set of guiding principles, which I think is very important. And I think the most important thing is an ecosystem-based approach to ensure that ecosystems underpin broader ocean development. So I think I'm just going to stick largely to the comments and specifically in relation to potential or recommendations on some potential amendments. The first thing that we commented on is existing rights, and I think, as Mr. Popoz said, that in some ways ocean activities are fairly locked into a specific configuration. I mean, we've got 98% of our EEZ is leased for some sort of oil and gas exploration or production. We've got 10% of our EEZ earlocked for seabed mining. We've got fishing rights, large concession areas for mining, as I said. And then in terms of Pakisa, there's also very much spatial implications of things like the aquaculture zones in terms of the aquaculture lab and bull, increased shipping, and increased coastal and marine interactions. So, I think within that context, one of the strong recommendations that we made is to have some sort of mechanism for dealing with existing rights where they conflict with the principles that are set out in the bill. So, for example, if you've got this earlock, how do you deal with the fact that 98% of our EEZ is earmarked for petroleum when that will have very definite implications for the ecosystem services that underpin our broader ocean economy? So, I mean, just some suggestions that we had is to align this with a proper regulatory system for existing rights, including specific EIA processes, EMPs, spatially sensitive guidelines, tools, and other regulatory instruments to align MSP principles with existing rights. Also, potentially a provision to provide for the legal withdrawal or repeal or expropriation of existing rights, such as 98% of our EEZ earmarked for oil and gas. A lot of the existing rights in our EEZ are also temporally defined. So I think an important part of an MSP process is that temporal dimension as well. So in order to ensure strategic lapsing of rights that aren't continued if they don't serve in terms of the broader marine area plans. Another one of our comments on the bill was, how does this align with a range of other ocean-related or non-ocean-related legal instruments that have special management tools already in place? And these are largely vested with different government departments within separate mandates and separate legal instruments. So, I mean, just some examples are coastal protection zones, coastal protected areas, MPAs, aquaculture development zones, fisheries management areas, no-go areas, small-scale fishing community areas, and things like no-go areas for petroleum in terms of the MPRDA. All of these are already responsibilities of different departments, and in some ways they are better placed in these with these existing authorities and mandates. But I think just in terms of regulatory clarity, there's not a lot of certainty on how these will be aligned to the MSP process or how it will, whether it will remain with different departments or become part of one of the proposed institutional structures of MSP. Then once again, alignment with other legislation. I mean, there's a whole a broad range of legal instruments that I don't think the MSP bill yet captures how it's going to align with these. I mean, this is just a list of some of the legal instruments that I think needs a lot more closer alignment on how these are going to interact with MSP, especially things like the Integrated Coastal Management Act in terms of mandates, in terms of responsibilities, and then very much in terms of international and regional agreements that have a range of spatial implications and planning tools and commitments, such as the Convention on Biological Diversity, the Benguela Current Convention, and I think it's very important that the bill is aligned with existing South African legislation and also international and regional commitments. One of the provisions in a previous iteration of the bill was a kind of enabling provision that all other government departments and all decision-making and marine, all licensing, permitting, permissions and authorizations needed to comply with both marine area plans and marine spatial plans. I think that was a critical provision, and it's been removed from this iteration. So essentially, it sought to bind organs of state to marine spatial plans and decisions and ensure coordination between different departments and sectors, and it created some degree of regulatory certainty on what happens if any permitting is issued that's contrary to the marine spatial plan or marine area plans. And I think that's been taken out, and I think that really... a strong recommendation that's reincorporated, because the entire credibility of an MSP system depends on having some sort of binding status on other organs of state and individuals. One of the important issues we also raised is the need for some kind of independent appeal authority. I mean, I think in most of these major enabling legislative frameworks, you usually tend to have some kind of independent appeal authority before final recourse is sought in the court system. Just a strong recommendation is to have some sort of institutional structure around appeals, where any appeal can be lodged against decisions relating to both marine spatial planning by persons directly affected and other interested and affected parties. We just provided a sort of model provision based on the Water Tribunal in terms of the Water Act. It's a good model provision for an independent appeal authority, and in some ways it's quite can be quite functional. So, I mean, one of our major comments is we've done a kind of lot of review on international best practice and what processes other countries have used in what you can call successful MSP. And the basis of MSP is stakeholder engagement and consultation. It's all about trade-offs and different interests and weighing these up under a framework of principled decision making, such as ecosystem based approaches. And at this stage, I don't think the consultation provision in the bill is yet strong enough. Second of all, there's an institutional issue because it doesn't yet place it currently places onus of consultation with a national working group. And that's a technical structure. It's a technical committee, and it's not suited to undertaking this type of consultation and stakeholder engagement. One of the things that CER has been involved with is a kind of process. We co-hosted a workshop on the civil society role of marine spatial planning and what civil society organizations would want from an MSP process. And one of the strong issues that came up, a key outcome and recommendation, is the need for a proper...
Mr. Roth?
Just be closer to the mic so that the recording is
Okay. Sure. And one of the key outcomes of this process is the strong need for an institutional structure for open, accountable, collaborative stakeholder engagement and consultation. So, I mean, it's really a strong recommendation that there should be some kind of forum, some kind of stakeholder forum that's suitably open and comprised of stakeholders from government departments, community groups, the private sector, conservation management agencies, the not-for-profit sector, academia, and the broader marine scientist community, and any relevant interested and affected stakeholders. I'm not going to repeat this, but this was one of the outcomes or recommendations that came from this kind of civil society process. I think one of the important things is the potential to align this with the current institutional structure. So you have representation and structure of the national forum, and then co-chairs sitting on the proposed regional planning institutional structures. One of the differences is instead of Prince Edward Islands, we said that there should be some kind of offshore institutional structure for stakeholder engagement, and that this should be aligned to the national working groups. So this is just a representation of what was proposed as a potential structure. So you get the national working group, you get the marine area planning groups, and then you can get regional consultation forums that speak to each other and align with each other. Another potential suggestion is to essentially have a comparable institutional structure to what's outlined in ICMA, which are essentially provincial coastal committees and municipal coastal committees. There is a potential to include a similar institutional structuring provision, and it's easily to model that on ICMA, ICMA's enabling provision. So we just drafted a potential enabling provision that would do that sort of play that role. And it's very straightforward. I mean, it's essentially word for word from ICMA that you have some kind of ministerial discretion to set up marine spatial planning committees 12 months after the commencement of the Act, and what the kind of broad overall responsibility or role to promote integrated ocean management and coordinate an effective implementation of marine area plans, and advise the proposed institutional structures such as the Director General's Committee and Ministerial Committee, just in general to promote a coordinated approach to the implementation of marine area plans. Within ICMA there's a range of just enabling provisions of who should be comprised in these sort of portfolio, these institutional committees. Also, one of the things that we've strongly recommended is alignment with some sort of environmental management framework. I mean, marine spatial planning without regulatory tools around a range of different issues, including environmental management, has the risk of becoming ocean zoning. And I think that was in kind of ideas around a SEMA, Specific Environmental Management Act for the Oceans, was sort of part of the thinking around PAKISA, the governance lab. And I think such legislation is critical for ocean governance, and I think it really should be aligned in some way with an MSP bill. To provide guidance in environmental management around spatial planning, including conditions for permitting, licensing, and authorization. Another key issue around marine spatial planning is the need for a lot of information transfer, a lot of knowledge transfer, and quite simple processes around engagement around information. And I don't think at this stage, currently the bill, the information, access to information provision is really captures the extent of information and knowledge exchange you need for these sort of processes. Another area of concern that we commented on is the publication of marine area plans. At the current iteration, it seems like there isn't going to be consultation around the actual publication of marine area plans, only the kind of broad marine spatial planning framework. And I would say that you need to have a strong both publication and public consultation provision within marine area plans. I mean, even in any kind of spatial planning process, you need intense consultation, intense engagement. So, I mean, just in, for example, in Spluma, you've got a 60-day commenting period for development of any national, regional, provincial, or municipal spatial development framework. And I think it just is common sense to have a similar provision for marine area plans. I mean, these are a lot larger planning areas that we're working with. And this is just essentially in the interests of fairness, clarity, and participation and accountable public administration. I mean, this is just a potentially a model of a potential provision around publication of marine area plans. And it's very straightforward. It's just a 60-day commenting period. Notices in various, in the Gazette and other available publications, and then some sort of engagement in that process. So just a quick summary of the key recommendations we made in our comments. To repeat, some sort of provision for the potential to withdraw and or repeal rights that conflict with the actual principles around marine spatial planning. And conflicts within marine area plans that are problematic. Some sort of reiteration or affirmation of powers around spatial management that are currently in existing legislative frameworks to better align it with existing ocean governance legislation and international and regional commitments. Some sort of provision around the status of decision-making around MSP and some sort of binding instrument or binding provision around how other organs of state need to comply with marine spatial planning processes. And I think this was our strongest recommendation, is to have some sort of enabling provision around stakeholder engagement, whether it's a stakeholder forum or MSP committees. Those were some examples. An independent appeal authority, and then very much some sort of process of developing a environmental management framework for marine spatial planning, and access to information, and then finally a provision for commenting on marine area plans. Thank you very much for your time.
Oh, thanks a lot. We can as well give him a round of applause. You did talk to the bill, various aspects worth considering. If there's anything, I think we'll get back to you. But later, as we conclude all presentations, usually we get the department to respond to those things that clarity is there already, just for that interaction, and the rest the committee will process as we conclude. But thanks a lot for your input.
Thank you very much, Honorable Chair. Okay.
I think they are available. What we did not have, I think the slides were those from Mr. Craig Foster. But I think we can get that presentation later. It's safe. Yeah, so it will be made available to members as well. Thanks a lot. Okay. We now are going to receive a presentation from Equitable Access Campaign, represented by Mr. G. Grayson. Is he here? Yeah. Oh, okay. Thanks. You can come forward.
Mark? Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Teleka. Thank you. Good day, everybody. Thank you very much for this opportunity. This is the subtitle to presentation, another lifeless piece of legislation for the people of the Northern Cape Littoral, or good governance and equitable access at last. I don't mean to sound facetious, but this is not the first time I've been in Parliament on behalf of my community. The EAC has on two previous occasions participated, and it was a waste of time, and in fact it left us quite dispirited. So our hopes are with the Portfolio Committee on Environmental Affairs and with the department with regards to the Marine Spatial Planning Bill, because it makes a lot of common sense and it provides for an orderly and fair and equitable ocean governance. I'd just like to briefly give some credentials regarding the EAC and its background. The EAC is the voice of the small-scale marine diamond mining industry. The ESC was established at Maesvlak on the 28th of April 2010, where the Maesvlak Manifesto was recorded. All of the information in this presentation obviously will be provided post the presentation. The Maesvlak Manifesto is really a principled view of how the Northern Cape marine mining industry should be structured. I won't go through the manifesto, but it sets out the reasonable expectations of the people of the Namaqualand Littoral. It was shortly after the founding meeting of the EAC at Maesvlak. It was signed by all of the Northern Cape small-scale marine miners. So these are all of the guys that the EAC represents. And what you see there is what constitutes all of the small-scale marine miners. So we're not AstroTurf, we are grassroots. past EAC parliamentary engagements, we made a written and oral submission to Parliament during public hearings on the establishment of a state-owned mining company on the 11th of August 2010. We made written and oral submissions to Parliament during the public hearings for the mining charter review on 14 September 2011. We submitted a detailed report to the Mineral Resources Portfolio Committee on the dire situation in the diamond diving industry on 28 July 2013. And we see, for our part, the DMR as the biggest obstacle to the objectives of the MSP bill becoming a reality for the Northern Cape coastal community. The MPRDA, the Marine, Mineral and Petroleum Resources Development Act, is in our view a promise broken in more ways than we can shake a stick at. The MPRDA's primary purpose of equitable access to South Africa's mineral resources is meaningless to the diamond diving industry and the rural communities within which it operates. The division of effort and reward is in no way calibrated on the principle of equitable access. Notwithstanding that equitable access is the raison d'etre for the MPRDA, the entire industry is controlled by Transhex and Alex Corp, so with nowhere else to go, the diamond divers must take it or leave it. Archie Uwies echoed the despair of the industry during the first EAC town hall meeting in Port Nolloth with the following words: Julle beteken absoluut niks, en die charter beteken ook niks, want julle het geen politieke mag nie. I made a promise then to Buta Archie that we will get our professional freedom, and I'm here today honoring that promise by telling the truth about our industry. Some personal background. I joined the South African Navy at the age of 17 after matriculating at Finance High School in 1980 and qualified as a Part 2 clearance diver. I've been active in the diamond diving industry since 1985, specializing in diamond diving operations and marine mining engineering. I have over 4,000 hours in diamond diving time. 300 hours of those were logged in Angola's Chicapa River in Lundersul in zero visibility. I've successfully completed a total of 70 turnkey diamond mining vessels, barges, and shore units on behalf of 46 different local and international clients, including Alex Corp, Transex, ODM, Benco, Southern Era, Petra Diamonds, the Mineral Services Group, Gem Diamonds, Jindal Minerals, the Lev Levayev Group, and 23 individual small-scale marine mining contractors in the West Coast diamond industry. More than half of the current Northern Cape diamond diving fleet has been produced by me. In 2011, I experienced the best that diamond diving can bring when my wife and I wrote our daughter's name in diamonds weighing over 1,000 carats. In January 2006, I experienced the second worst that diamond diving can bring when I had to recover the crushed body of a fellow diamond diver, Derek Deploy, from beneath a 5-ton rock a few hours after we had shared a conversation on the quay of Alexander Bay Harbor. This is just a video of the scene where the accident took place. I'm just going to try and fast forward it. That's the rock which fell upon Derek. It's a 5-ton rock. That dark space is the space his body was trapped in. His entire body was crushed from his head down to his hips. That's the harness he was wearing at the time, which I had to cut off his body. I took this video for the inquiry subsequent to the accident. That there is the small space into which his body was crushed. What you're seeing there in my hand are what remains of the demand valve that was in his mouth when the rock collapsed on him. It crushed the demand valve and broke it into pieces, and those pieces were scattered around his head when I recovered his body. Some industry background. In the early years, during a period of abundance in diamonds and a highly favorable climate, diamond diving operations were performed in-house by the large corporate concession owners. The mining methods and equipment developed for mining in the surf zone have remained unchanged for 40 years. Consequently, the mining efforts of the industry have been confined to the relatively small portion of the total resource for which it is equipped. The lack of technical innovation, depletion of the technically accessible diamonds, and the devastating impacts of climate change have brought the diamond diving industry to its knees. By the turn of the millennium, both concession owners had found it impossible to operate profitably, so they outsourced the challenge to the local diamond diving community, who are expected to be profitable while giving off 50% to the concession owner. In other words, the same people who know that they could not make a profit with a comparative advantage of 100% beneficial interest expect the under-resourced local small-scale marine miners to do it on a 50% beneficial interest. And I ask, how is this possible in full view of Parliament? This is an extract from one of Alex Gore's annual reports showing the decline in sea days resulting from climate change. We had regularly years before 2000 of annual sea days in excess of 140. The worst year was 2008 when it declined to around about, I think it was 11 sea days. So we won't argue about whether climate change is what the causes are, but we can tell you that the effects are there. We experience it quite dramatically in our industry. I have to give a bit of a snapshot of our industry, because in order to understand why the MSP bill is so important to our particular industry, you need to have some insight to the industry, because it's not like any other industry. It's an extremely unusual industry. It takes place only in one place in the world, and that's on the west coast of South Africa, north and south of the Orange River. The reason for that is when the erosive processes that released diamonds from the kimberlite pipes into the oceans took place, there was some continental isostasy which raised the east coast and lowered the west coast, so the drainage was all westward. Strengths. The West Coast diamond diving industry are leaders in diver-based mining. Some of you have probably seen the Alaskan gold diving program on TV. Those guys are decades behind our technology. And Africa's riverine diamond mining industry is totally reliant on South African expertise. I've done a lot of work in Central Africa, and before South African diamond diving expertise migrated into Central Africa and West Africa, the local garimpeiros would dive down a wooden pole from a dugout canoe and collect the gravel with a bucket called a borache, it's Portuguese, and they would breathe from a surgical rubber hose pipe stuck in the side of their mouth. So our technology that we've developed has had quite a significant impact on the riverine diamond mining industry in Angola, Sierra Leone, Guinea, and a number of other countries north of us. Another thing that is a great strength for our industry is the pristine world-class diamond reserves. Now, this is not very well known. A lot of people believe that the West Coast diamond industry is tapering off now, it's coming to an end because the diamonds are finished. It's not the case. The Orange River Delta megaplaza is the most important diamond deposit on Earth. The four terrestrial terraces extending inland from the coast in a narrow strip supported 90 years of intensive mining and provided millions of carats of high-quality diamonds. This, however, is a minor portion of the overall deposit, the major portion of which is deposited along submerged ancient beach terraces that echo the terrestrial terraces more than 20 kilometers into the Atlantic Ocean and beyond. So for the past 90 years, the companies like CDM, with De Beers, and the earlier state alluvial diggings, Alliscor and Transex, in these mines from Honokla Bay and Mitchell's Bay and those areas right up to into Namibia, those mining operations have been focused on mining the land wave cut terraces. Because of changes in sea level over millions of years, as a result of changes in climate, where you have ice age, you'll have polar max, and most of the water, a lot of the ocean water, gets pulled up into the polar caps. And when you have polar max, you have ocean minimum. And the opposite happens when you have polar minimum, then you have ocean max. So as a result of over geological timescales and changes in sea level, wherever the sea level has stopped for a period of time, you've had a terrace cut into the base rock. Now, those terraces, which run like a giant staircase, out into the ocean and right out towards the edge of the continental shelf, those terraces are highly mineralized with diamonds. So the four terraces that have been mined out on land are only a minor portion of the overall West Coast diamond placer. Those four terraces are limited to a band of around about a kilometer wide. So in order to get some kind of perspective of what we're talking about, think of it as a deposit that runs more or less north-south and is approximately 25 kilometers wide, and the land mining only constituted 1 kilometer of that. Those same terraces that have been mined on land, they also echo out into the deeper water. So the West Coast diamond industry has only really mined out the minor portion of the overall deposit, because it's the low-hanging fruit, because it's on land. It's a lot easier to mine on land than what it is to mine on in the sea. On land, you can go to Barlow's and you can go and pick your mining equipment. On sea, you've got to design and build your own equipment and operate it yourself. You can't go to any capital equipment manufacturer or OEM and ask him to provide you with the tools to do it. They don't exist. You've got to do it yourself. Weaknesses. Currently, there's no shallow water remote mining technology available for small-scale marine miners to transition from diver-based operations to mechanized operations. There are no incentives to offset the risk of developing new technology. It's been tried before by ODM, it was tried by TransX, it was tried by Alliscor, and they have far deeper pockets than the small-scale marine miners, and they failed in their attempts. There's no political will to enable that the development of the inshore diamond, notwithstanding the PAKISA and ocean economy policy drives. The industry is extremely concentrated in the hands of two outsiders with no inshore mining credentials and no sense of the development imperative, no opportunity for local beneficiation and participation in the value chain. And the value chain is quite significant, because for every 100 rand that we generate at the mine gate, that becomes around about 700 rand when it gets to Shemansky. So over the past 17 years, the diamond diving business at Alliscor has produced around about 2 billion rands worth of diamonds in value at the mine gate. So that translates to 12 billion rands worth of economic value added to the South African economy. There's disposition and loss of critical harbor infrastructure. Port Nolloth Harbor used to be a diamond mining harbor. Honokla Bay used to be a diamond mining harbor. There's no infrastructure in Honokla Bay. It's been wiped out by severe weather events. And in Port Nolloth, the jetty, which is available for diamond divers to use, has been kept by Transet. There's no access to that, and De Beers have got the other jetty. So if diamond mining vessels want to offload in Port Nolloth, they have to get permission from De Beers, and then have to get make arrangements for the De Beers crane to offload the gravel. But even it being traditionally a diamond diving port, there's no provision for the diamond divers. Before the money bill changed the royalties, up until around about 2010, from the time that Alice Corp started outsourcing in 1999 to 2010, the diamond divers, what they produced from the sea, translated to 90 million in royalties. But we can't even get a crane built for us in Port Nollet. Another big problem for us is our total exclusion from the local government IDP and its local economic development strategy. Now, it's unbelievable that an industry which has produced 2 billion rands worth of diamonds over the past 15 to 17 years doesn't get a look in on the IDP. We know we're in the IDP and we know we're in the local economic development strategy. How is that possible? Overregulation but no charter enforcement. The DMR is over us all the time about safety. Some of the safety issues are certainly necessary. Some of them are in our view petty. They're trying to enforce first world offshore oil and gas type legislation on us when we are actually survival entrepreneurs. So it would be fine if they enforced the charter and we got the good with the bad. But as far as the DMR is concerned, we only get the things which keep the boot on our necks and we get nothing to lift us up. Consequently, there's no access to funding. You will find it very difficult to go to a bank and get funding for a small-scale marine mining operation. We have no defense against monopoly control. There's a loss of cohesion due to divide and rule approach from monopoly control. There's a lack of active citizenship due to a fear of victimization and many more. Opportunities. There are many big, fast wins possible with immediate intervention. If only Pakisa knew of our existence. Heavy industrialization and a total makeover of the literal socio-economic landscape in the medium to long term. The scale of the Namaqualand diamond deposit offers an opportunity to build out a world-class marine mining industry that can flourish for the next 100 years. The market fundamentals for diamonds are robust in the short, medium, and long term. This is a chart from 3W. They are diamond consultants based in London. This is their predictions, and we know at 2017 they've been pretty accurate. So there's a deficit. There were predictions made by analysts that there's only another 20 years worth of diamonds left in the ground. When the land diamonds are all finished, it's all going to be in the sea. And what people need to understand is that the center for diamond diving, for diamond mining worldwide, is going to be concentrated in Alexander Bank, Port Nollet. They're going to be very, very different places to what they are today because they're sitting and straddling the largest and most important diamond deposit in the world. Another great opportunity is the Industrial Internet of Things and Industry 4.0. They have already given birth to the technologies needed to unlock the immense value of Namaqualand's marine diamond endowment. But the integration of those technologies into new cost-effective mining solutions, while urgently required, is hamstrung due to a severe lack of incentives, funding and effort, but most of all, equitable access. I think we all realize now that the rate of change technically around the world is accelerating at a phenomenal rate, and everything's changing. You know, whether it's Amazon delivering your parcel by drone, or whether it's Elon Musk terraforming the planet Mars, we are in for a very, very different future to the one that we can look back on. So shallow water mining, in terms of the technology needed to do it, is actually a sitting duck. In 2015, I visited Norway and a number of other Scandinavian countries, Germany and the UK, looking at different kinds of technology. The technology is all there, but it's impossible when you don't have any right of tenure and you have deals that barely keep you alive to go out and try and harness those types of technology and integrate them into mining solutions that can do what needs to be done. The technically demanding nature of heavy underwater intervention implicit in the build-out of Marine Diamond Mining 2.0 provides a platform on which to profoundly transform our community and create a prosperous modern economy in much the same way that offshore oil and gas did for Aberdeen. Because I'm a diamond diver and I come out of a diving background, when I did my Navy training, I actually swore I'd never be a diamond diver. It was not for me. I was going to go to the North Sea and be a sat diver. So I know a little bit about the history of the North Sea oil and gas industry and how the oil and gas industry transformed Aberdeen. And the situation that we have now at the moment with what Aberdeen had as a oil and gas resource in their waters, we have a similar scenario except it's diamonds. So we have a world-class diamond deposit in our local waters, and the type of industries and technologies that are going to be necessary to unlock that value are very tech intensive. So that provides a platform for us to industrialize the Namaqualand Littoral, but in a way that's technology dense. I'm not talking about black smoke industrialization. I'm talking about the kind of industrialization I saw when I went to Trondheim in Norway, where you have these beautiful waterfronts, but in the midst of this waterfront, you'll have a massive oil and gas ship dock. So it's all technology driven and it's all kept very clean, and we're not saying that we want to go and drill the West Coast like the oil and gas guys have done, because diamond is different and the technology you need to do it is different. And you don't have the risks of things like the deepwater horizon in the Gulf of Mexico, which devastated the marine environment. I'm talking about good industrialization, smart, with a variety of different types of technical domains, from a hydrographic survey, you know, geology, you know, the diamond diving, or rather the diving and underwater intervention space is of necessity a very sexy space to play in. It's just very expensive. Okay, threats. I don't know if the committee is aware of the boundary dispute between Namibia and South Africa. In 2015, I was doing research on the geology of the diamond placer that's in the Orange River Delta, and I came across an article about the maritime boundary dispute, where President Mbeki had backtracked on an apparent deal which Sam Nujoma did with President Mandela when President Mandela became president. He said, "Can't you do something about the boundary?" And I locked onto this and I started reading about it. And a lot of people think that the border between Namibia and South Africa is the middle of the Orange River. It's not. It's the northern bank of the Orange River. Now that has huge implications for the maritime boundary dispute, because your maritime boundary starts where the land terminus point is, the LTP. That's where your border ends, your land border ends. That's where your maritime boundary starts. So the Namibians want to move the boundary forward by about 1.2 kilometers because the delta is quite wide. And when President Mbeki realized the implications of it, he said, look, there's just no ways we can do that. So not long after that, I attended the 2015 Hydrographic International Hydrographic Society conference at the...
Mr. Kaysom.
Yeah.
May I caution you not to be all over? Stick to your presentation so that we are able to give other presenters and be able to conclude by one. But I don't want to stop you necessarily.
Okay.
I'm saying proceed and move towards the conclusion.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, I think I'd just like to show something to the committee. The keynote address was given by Mr. Rob van der Pol of Fugro in Canada. And this is a slide taken from his address where he's saying that this is another boundary. He's in charge of the UNCLOS, United Nations Convention of the Law of the Sea. And you can see there when it comes to marine spatial planning, you've got a huge problem because there's a chunk of delta there which Rob van der Pol valued at $630 million at 2015 production estimates. So I think it's something that needs to be brought into the discussion because it's being kept very, very hush-hush, and it affects us in a big way as diamond divers because the northern extent of our area that we can work is in dispute between the South African government and the Namibian government. Okay. This is another issue about marine spatial planning because it goes to the heart of equitable planning about how different industries work together in a common space. This is a document outlining the the plans that Transex have to consolidate the entire West Coast diamond industry from Durung Bay past the Orange River and even into Namibia. So what you see there is the master plan, and that's why Christa Visa has taken Transex private. And it's something that we were never consulted on. I was given this document by a hitchhiker I picked up hiking from Alexander Bay to Port Nolloth. He told me the story, and I said to him, it can't be true. When we arrived to Port Nolloth, he went and knocked on a door and came out with this document. And I subsequently found that this document is not fake news, it's a real document, and I'll provide the document for the to the committee. Monopoly control is a big problem for our industry. In a submission I made to Byron Peterson, the chief executive officer of De Beers in South Africa, when we were fighting against the inclusion of the shore concessions in the sale of the Namaqualand mines to Transex, we had the following to say, the presence or absence of equitable access will determine the success or failure of the entire mining industry in South Africa. Without it, there can be no transformation and therefore no sustainability. The insiders would be wrong to think that their monopolies are unassailable. One way or another, they will pass on. Only the time and manner thereof remains uncertain. Perhaps the first hint of this took place in 2004 when President Thabo Mbeki was outraged at the comments made by Mr. Tony Treyar on the political risks in South Africa. The ANC government had given South Africa's powerful monopolies their best years ever, and they had the least reason of all to be negative about South Africa's future. We believe he felt betrayed. The irony is that much of the political instability in South Africa today is due to a lack of shared growth, for which those who wield monopoly power must accept their share of responsibility. Consider the heavy caseload of the Competition Commissioner. This was written in 2011, so it's not based on ANN7 or current news flows. This was written in 2011. Another big problem for us is sweetheart mining contracts for politically connected newcomers. Alicecore has signed over exclusive rights to mine the midwater and deepwater concession on terms which are far more favorable than those than those granted to the local SSMMEs who have kept the SAE going for almost 20 years. This is the moral equivalent of the deal between the SABC and MultiChoice for the rights of the broadcaster's archives. It also hollows out the value of the land claim settlement for the Richtersveld community, and it also limits the future options for the local miners. Another threat to our industry is ongoing internecine disputes between Alexcor and the Richtersveld community, as well as internal disputes between rival factions within the successful land claimants. So you have a situation where you have a land claim, and then you have negotiations which eventually get concluded, which have a huge impact on the diamond diving industry, but the diamond diving industry has no say. So we sit now in a situation where for 18 years we've had no certainty in our industry, because first of all, Alexcor kept saying, well, they can't do this or they can't do that because of the land claim. And they're now still arguing with the Richtersveld community and battling to get certain things put in place. So for us, it's an ongoing situation of uncertainty. And this is probably the most serious of the threats to the industry: the rapid spread of large-scale indiscriminate seawall mining. Seawall material is defined as residue stockpile. Residue stockpile means any debris, discard, tailings, slimes, screening, slurry, waste rock, foundry sand, beneficiation plant waste, ash, or any other product derived from or incidental to a mining operation, and which is stockpiled, stored, or accumulated for potential reuse, or which is disposed of by the holder of a mining right, mining permit, production right, or an old order right. So there can be no question that the definition of the material that is used to build seawalls is a residue stockpile. The seawall material is defined as residue stockpile in terms of Section 2 of the MPRDA and is therefore the responsibility of the DEA to monitor, as provided for in the NEMA Waste Act. Until recently, mining waste was regulated under the Mineral and Petroleum Resources Development Act. With effect from 24 July 2015, the establishment and reclamation of mine dumps and stockpiles of similar waste from or incidental to a mining operation must comply with the new regulations regarding the planning and management of residue stockpiles and residue deposits from a prospecting, mining, exploration, or production operation. Mining residue regulations published under the National Environmental Management Act, Waste Act 59 of 2008. The mining residue regulations supersede Regulation 73 of the Mineral and Petroleum Resources Development Regulations, which previously regulated mining waste. Most of the provisions in the mining residue regulations echo those in Regulation 73 of the MPRD regulations, but there are some significant challenges which are now discussed below. A full scoping and environmental assessment is required if the waste is generated by activities requiring a mining right, exploration right, or production right. This means that the mining industry will now have to pay for more detailed and stringent EIA process involving considerably more public participation than was previously case under the MPRDA. As far as the...
May I give you 3 minutes to wrap up?
Okay. Let me get away from the law. I think I've covered enough of the law. Okay, the practice is extremely harmful. As you can see, this is in 2016. Those seawalls are out here somewhere now. This is a historical seawall mining operation conducted by Alexcor before my time. So this would have been sometime in the 1990s. And what I put into Google Earth here are two data sets. The first data set, which is the white what ADEFCON tours is the pristine bathymetry of this particular bay. This is Heel Durham. Okay? The current bathymetry, that red line is the 10-meter contour. So the entire bathymetry of Heel Durham has actually been changed by about 4 meters. And instead of it having that that channel running out there now, the entire bay is now filled with sediment that's been pulled out from these operations over here. There's a massive skills deficit compounded by over-regulation, loss of the diamond diving ecosystem. In the past, the industry was supported by a range of prosperous local trading and engineering businesses that played an important role in ensuring that the diamond diving fleet was properly maintained. These businesses have fallen by the wayside, along with so many of the SSMEs that have failed to cope with increasing hardship. This has resulted in the added burden of SSMEs having to equip themselves to carry out light engineering themselves, or grind to a halt when faced by breakdowns, which are a common occurrence due to the harsh operating environment and the old age of the mining fleet. A very inequitable share of the national revenue collected and of the infrastructure spend. Of a total of 19 ports and commercial harbors around South Africa's coastline, the Northern Cape has none. We don't have a commercial harbor. There are 19 ports and commercial harbors around South Africa's coastline. The Northern Cape doesn't have one. Port Nolloth is not a commercial harbor. It's a big problem operating out of Port Nolloth because it's not deep enough to sustain commercial operations. So we have to ask ourselves, well, all of this value that's been taken out of the Makwaland and the environmental degradation left behind, how is it that we can't even have a commercial harbor? If I look at the equitable division of revenue bill, the last two bills, I noticed that the Richtersveld municipality receives the lowest portion of the equitable division, second last to the Lanesburg municipality. There's no security of tenure, fear of victimization, arbitrary decisions with highly negative impacts, weak to non-existent political top cover.
No, I exhausted your 3 minutes.
Okay, well, there we go. That's the last one. And I'd just like to finish off by saying the EAC supports the Marine Spatial Planning Bill and sincerely wishes the Department and the Portfolio Committee well taking it forward. Thank you.
Thanks a lot. A round of applause.
Sorry it took so long.
You were relaxed, I think. Okay.
Thanks.
May we receive the next presentation? Is from CPUT, Professor Finlay. It's not your first time here, I think, so you will know how we work.
Take on all
You won't give us a hard time, I think. Okay. Often we get told, we get told that we are harsh and so on and so on. It's not our own making. It's necessarily that we must be focused and be quite aware of our time limits because we don't have all the time. I want us to conclude before we start even losing some members who may need to leave or taking their flights to other commitments. So I want us to conclude when we are still a full complement. Thanks a lot. Over to you, Prof.
Thank you, Honourable Chair, Honourable Members, colleagues, guests. Thank you for the opportunity to comment on the Marine Spatial Planning Bill today. I had the privilege of... We've lost the link. I had the privilege of addressing the Parliamentary Portfolio Committee Environmental Affairs on Oceans Economies about a month to 6 weeks back. I would like to just start this talk off by a short recap
Some of the principles I put forward then, because they are of particular context in what I want to say in terms of my comments to the bill. We know worldwide that regions and nations are expanding their oceans economies. There's 7.5 billion humans on this planet, and we have to turn to new areas to foster economic growth and food and energy security. We as humans derive numerous market and non-market goods and services, benefits from ocean systems through our ocean's economies. I need to quickly go through these because they are important in how I will be encapsulating my comments. We have, and this is here I'm talking about the ecosystem service model, so that we have ecosystem services. We have provisioning services, and we've heard a lot this morning. We've heard about some fisheries, things like that. We have regulatory ecosystem services. The role that the ocean plays in advancing our ocean climate, hydrological cycles, carbon sinks, things like that. We have cultural ecosystem services, and I want to thank Craig Foster for a fantastic talk this morning, which encapsulated some of those cultural services that are quite difficult to put a handle on. The provisioning services are market services. They are products we take to market. They have a value. They have a price. The other two are non-market services and consequently are quite difficult to value. Very often they're taken for granted. Somebody said something about 2 out of every 3 breaths we take are provided by the ocean. How do we value those 2 breaths? On the other hand, we have what I want to say is that all ecosystem services, by very definition, are dependent on functional ecosystems, on ocean health. Without ocean health, ocean integrity, we don't have ecosystem services, and we're going to lose our ocean economies. On the other hand, we have environmental services, such as mining or transport, which are not dependent on ecosystem services. Members, that's not to say that they don't have the huge potential to impact the provision of ecosystem services. Those services give us our economies, our industry, our consumption. I think we're all well aware that consumption, economies, industry have externalities, and those externalities, those byproducts of those industries feed back and impact indirectly ocean health. Think climate change, ocean acidification, sea level rise, etc. I just want to put here then, just to capture this, ocean economies are dependent on ocean health and consequently on good ocean governance. Sorry, that shouldn't be there, but let's just run through this. On the one hand, we've got environment. On the other hand, we've got resource users. We get the environment driven by environmental function. We get services from the environment. Those services give us value across a whole range of particular industries and particular benefits. All of those occur in a limited ocean space. And while we talk about a very expansive EEZ and ocean space of South Africa, we've heard that this morning, many of these are coastal or occur in the shallow coastal waters because of the restriction of access in deep waters, so that there is huge potential for conflict between industries and conflict between industries and the environment. Those direct conflicts feed back into the system function, leading us with lower ecosystem services in a positive reinforcing negative cycle. Governance is what we require. We saw some spatial maps this morning. I've added this one now. I really wanted to just point out after the first talk this morning where we had the oil and gas sector in 2006, that bottom right figure is where we are now. We'll see that 98% of the area is assigned to acreage. How do you trade that off against the center bottom figure of proposed marine protected areas or shipping routes or in the top right, trawling zones, things like this? And this is really what marine spatial planning is all about. We want ocean governance to balance human benefits and ocean health. We're not in any way advocating a non-expansion in this area. It's the balance that we are seeking. We need governance, ocean governance, and I use a very nice definition of ocean governance as an informed decision-making process of trade-offs. We've heard about those already this morning. The model that I particularly like to use in ocean governance is Marlin Falkenmark's trilogue model that is an interlink of government, science, and society, and communication between these particular areas. This is particularly important in the stakeholder engagement. If I changed ocean governance there for marine spatial planning, which I consider to be one of the major ocean governance tools, the important thing is the stakeholder engagement between government with rulemaking, rule implementation, and rule adjudication, society consisting of the pillars of economy, the social fabric, and the environment, and science providing you with the knowledge bases, the information that we've heard about this morning that is critical to make informed decision trade-offs. So it's that communication that we're after. I want to just point out a paper that I came across relatively recently by Peter Jones, Liebeknecht, and Key, and it is a review of 12 MSP case studies in Europe, and it critically looked at these MSP case studies and identified that MSP is often focused on achieving specific sectoral objectives and might better be termed in these case studies as strategic sectoral planning. MSP tends to be complex, fragmented, and emergent on an ad hoc basis rather than cyclical and adaptive and prescribed on an a priori basis that is often in the MSP process literature. It seems to be a top-down process which tends to dominate, and blue growth is the dominant priority, often aligned with strategic sectoral priorities rather than balancing this expansion of ocean's economies and ocean health that I've been talking about. With regards to my particular comments to the Marine Spatial Planning Bill, and I'll be very brief here, firstly, I'm a little bit concerned in the definitions. There is a definition of a marine area plan, and it says a marine area plan means a biogeographic marine area, not an area plan. Okay, there's some wording missing there, I think. I would like to, particularly if we look at the earlier draft, where a marine area plan means the marine area plans, not the area. So I'd just like to propose that there's a rethink in the way that these are worded, that marine area is teased out, and marine area plan means the plan, not the area. Secondly, I'm quite concerned about, in the definitions, the definition of South African waters, because it explicitly says excludes all freshwater bodies and estuaries, i.e., that the Marine Spatial Planning Bill deals with territorial waters, the EEZ, and outwards from the baseline, but doesn't include inwards from the baseline in terms of between the low water mark and the high water mark as far as estuaries are concerned. South Africa has a very high energy coastline. That means that many of the recreational and tourism activities that are carried out by the South African population are carried out within estuary spaces which are relatively sheltered. And I feel that this needs to be addressed. I think we need to include estuaries within the marine spatial plan. And just finally, it's been said already, I'm not going to dwell on it. I think there's a need for a greater public participation process. In my comments, I requested a review period for stakeholders, for the public. I see that is addressed in Section 8. However, it's addressed at the National Working Group level, and I think it needs to be taken further down the process and either be and actually be there should be scope or potential for public comment, appeal, and participation in the publication process. What Mr. Roo was talking about in terms of the appeal process, similar to the Spluma landscape. Ladies and gentlemen, I thank you for my opportunity to comment, and I'll let it rest there. Thank you.
Thanks a lot. I think it's quite clear. We have your input here as well. So you spoke to your submission. If anything, we'll interact with you in that regard. Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thanks a lot. Following CPUT, it's going to be CSIR through Dr. L. Silas. Is it correct? Okay, all right.
Good morning, Honourable Chair, Honourable Members. This is my first time in this particular democratic process of our country, so thank you for the opportunity. I too will be quite brief. I want to give you some of our our insights on the Marine Spatial Planning Bill, and I will stick quite closely to our original submission, and also following quite closely, and I hope to make some links to the presentation by Saul Roo from CER. So I'm from the CSIR. My brief within my organization is to look at research and development of coastal and ocean governance, and it's in that capacity that I present on the Marine Spatial Planning Bill. So firstly, the CSIR acknowledges the elementary importance of Marine Spatial Planning Act, specifically to govern the allocation, exploitation, and management of ocean resources in a manner that's sustainable, equitable, transparent, and administratively responsible. So we absolutely agree with the motivation that was presented by the Department of Environmental Affairs for the need of a Marine Spatial Planning Act, and we feel that this bill is a critically important step towards developing such an act, and this presentation and our previous comments would be to improve the Marine Spatial Planning Bill so that we can have an act that is incorporated within the existing legislative framework intended to govern the, and this is important, the inseparable and seamless coastal and ocean environment. It may seem that they are separate, one is dry, one is wet, but in fact the economic benefits, the ecosystem processes are seamless between those two environments, and I'll make reference to that quite a number of times. In commenting on the bill, I make mention of four fundamental challenges that will need to be considered before the bill can actually be enacted. So in recognition of those four fundamental challenges, which I just briefly list here, but I will provide some more comment and context to those. In our opinion, the four fundamental challenges are the disproportionate effort to value, and I'll explain these, an unreasonable asymmetry comparing the coast to the oceans, insufficient transparency, inclusion and participation, and an unclear and incomplete administrative governance. So let's look at those four fundamental challenges. The slides are cut off at the top, so I'll just, by way of identifying them, look at this particular challenge of a disproportionate effort to value. So the Operations PAKISA and the Oceans Lab Initiative suggest that the ocean economy can contribute 177 billion rand to the South African GDP and create 1 million jobs. With such an incredibly valuable resource, we would require a commensurately meticulous attention to the legal framework that will govern the use of the space and the resources, in the same way that we have done for the coast. So you've heard mention that the ICM Act, amongst quite a number of other legislative instruments, provide an example and a precedence for the development of legislation intended to govern national resources of high value. So it is not unreasonable to expect that ocean governance must be underpinned by legislative framework that are at least as comprehensive as the National Environmental Management Integrated Coastal Management Act that was created to manage the valuable coastal resources of South Africa. So that's the mirror we're holding up to the Marine Spatial Planning Bill. Is it as comprehensive? Will it deal with and consider the resources in the same way that the ICM Act does for the coast? If not, there's a disproportionate effort to value. In other words, we need to pay more attention to how we govern the coast. Second challenge is this challenge of unreasonable asymmetry. And what I mean with that is, if you consider the coastal space compared to the ocean space, on the land side, the coast side, We have an extensive and comprehensive set of legislation to deal with both terrestrial and coastal spatial planning. This includes legislation like SPLUMA, the National Environmental Management Act itself, the National Environmental Management Integrated Coastal Management Act, Municipal Systems Act, and regulations dealing with environmental impact assessment, and many, many others. So this creates another precedent in terms of how you plan space. So taking that example, and we look at what the marine spatial planning, planning intends to create in the oceans, we would suggest that the lack of legislation, framework legislation, that we refer to as the National Environmental Management of the Oceans, or NEMO, is one of the most critical weaknesses of the current marine spatial planning bill, or any version of the bill for that matter. So effectively, without the NEMO, or we can also call it an Oceans Act, the marine spatial planning bill is inadequate as a proxy and lacks the overarching framework for ocean governance and the effective and coordinated role of marine spatial planning. I will not belabor this because I will point to it again in my conclusion. The third challenge that I think the bill currently faces is a challenge of insufficient transparency, inclusion, and participation. Currently, in our opinion, the bill promotes the sentiment out of sight, out of mind. So if I make a statement and I believe that it is true for the ocean resources as it is for the coast, and that statement is, it is an indisputable truth that the ocean resources are held in trust by the state on behalf of South Africans. So that statement is explicitly mentioned in the Integrated Coastal Management Act, but is absent from the Marine Spatial Planning Bill. That tends to indicate that the bill concentrates power at the national sphere of government, and that is not indicative of a willingness to consider the critical role of provincial and local government, civil society, including private sector, and many others. The word governance has been used quite a few times. I give you another definition. By saying effective governance can be conceived as a framework of accountability and responsibility to users, stakeholders, and the wider community that also includes formal and informal arrangements, structures, functions, institutions, and organizational traditions and values that have been put in place to achieve its objectives in an effective and transparent manner. Holding that definition up against the bill, there seems to be, generally speaking, a weakness in the creation of governance structures for the ocean space. The final of our major challenges that we suggest the bill needs to still address is a challenge of unclear and incomplete and administrative governance. How to make the bill implementable, how to make the bill work, or the act work. So the current version of the bill does not create the relationship between the data-intensive marine planning process and the burden of accountability required for spatial data within the SDI, or spatial data infrastructure framework. It also fails to provide mechanisms for the policy process. I find it difficult to identify a policy process in the Marine Spatial Planning Bill similar to the Integrated Coastal Management Act and its implementation. Some specifics: the bill neglects to reference the Spatial Data Infrastructure Act as the national regulatory framework for the provision and maintenance of spatial data for the government entities. That's particularly important because we're talking about marine spatial planning, data heavy, and that link is absolutely critical. There's also no, in our opinion, no governance mechanisms to inform, govern, or monitor the implementation of marine area plans. This points again to the lack of a recognizable policy process for the implementation of marine spatial planning. If you think back about to some of the comments by CER previously, it links quite closely to the processes required to govern the ocean space. So in conclusion, honorable members, we feel that the Act and MSP Act located or incorporated within the framework of an Oceans Act, or as we refer to it, the National Environmental Management of the Oceans, is indeed critically important for South Africa. What we, however, question is the sequence of legislative planning that resulted in a marine spatial planning bill being presented prior to the development of a National Environmental Management of the Oceans Act. The bill cannot compensate in its current format for the lack of an Oceans Act that was previously initiated as the National Environmental Management of the Oceans. Effectively, the bill cannot stand as a proxy for an Oceans Act. In our opinion, the Marine Spatial Bill is positioned in a legislative vacuum. It's not sufficiently comprehensive as a proxy, as I've mentioned. And in our opinion, the remedy for this, although not simple, but logical, is that all efforts should be focused on the development of an Oceans Act or a national specific Environmental Management of the Oceans Act that is at least as comprehensive as for the coastal domain and the precedent created by the Integrated Coastal Management Act. We look forward to a future where we have two complementary acts that are equally strong in the coast and the oceans, and within which marine spatial planning can take place, effectively, responsibly, transparently governed by a Marine Spatial Planning Act. I thank you for your time and attention.
Thanks a lot, Prof. Silius. Thanks for your input. Let's now proceed to the following. Mr. Bell, representing the Western Cape Provincial Government. Wherever we were, we used to receive some input from the provinces where we went. We had a rep in George, but probably you still need to make another input, more focused perhaps this time, not by way of welcoming us into the province.
I'm not sure what input was given in Georgia.
It's on the desktop.
Robertus.
Honourable Chair, honourable members, thank you for the opportunity. As for some other speakers here today, this is also my first time addressing a parliamentary committee. I'm a town and regional planner, so I feel a bit out of place here with the marine space. But nevertheless, my role in the provincial government is mainly to look at and support municipalities with land use planning legislation. So we've had references here this morning to Splumar, for instance, that is an act that we regularly deal with. In the Western Cape, we have the Land Use Planning Act, and there is also municipal planning bylaws. So that is mostly what we deal with, and then we get this marine spatial bill that landed on our desks lately. And I must say that it does have an impact on what we as, let's call ourselves then, terrestrial planners. My presentation is quite short. We have submitted written comments on the bill, and it is not my intention to just sit here and repeat those. What I want to do is just highlight some of the aspects of our comments, and there are certain points that I think one should look at. The first is the jurisdiction of this bill. The second would be integrated planning. The other would be the Coastal Management Act. And lastly, representation on various of the governance structures. In 6.2 of the Memorandum of Objects, we see this paragraph in italics there, and it recognizes that harbors will be substantially impacted by this bill. And I want to echo that, and I must say that there's a lot in the bill that can be improved insofar as harbors are concerned. We've heard from previous speakers as well what the importance of harbors are. But harbors are a contested space. I mean, there's the municipality that operates there, there's the Department of Public Works, there's fisheries, and so we can carry on. So if this Act seeks to control that as well, then we need to perhaps have a re-look at that. Then I think it was the prof from UCT that also referred to South African waters, and the it says there that it includes inland waters, and then inland waters in the Maritime Zones Act is all waters landward of the baseline of all harbours. Now, presumably, and hopefully we're not wrong, but this means that the bill could be interpreted to have an application on inland waters as well, such as rivers and dams. And that is perhaps not the intention of this bill. So that could possibly be looked at. I'm not going to go into the estuaries that was mentioned by a previous speaker. But yeah, the way the jurisdiction part is worded is that it does not provide sufficient guidance to terrestrial planners, local, regional, and so forth, as to the physical jurisdiction of this bill. Then, as far as I'm concerned, one of the areas for further improvement would be the integration with provincial and municipal planning. Marine spatial planning cannot ignore and plan in isolation from terrestrial planning. We've heard that a couple of times today, and it is interesting to me that individually and objectively the same sort of message starts coming through. Everything that will be done in terms of marine spatial planning will eventually be linked to terrestrial planning and have implications, especially for the coastal provinces, even if it's just for an access road, for instance. And then there was the previous speaker mentioned the Municipal Systems Act, which in my life plays a big role, and that is not cross-referenced in this bill. And I fail to see why, because the Systems Act requires a municipality to have an IDP, an integrated development plan, which is often described as the whole of government plan. And we do not see how the Marine Spatial Bill is trying to integrate or connect with what the MSA seeks to achieve. And the spaces are next to each other. The boundary, the physical boundary between it is blurred, and they have effects vice versa. Municipalities therefore have to ensure that the compatibility of plans is considered when they do their planning, and it appears as if this act is standing a bit in isolation of that. I just want to highlight this point. You were yesterday, I believe, in Saldanha. I happen to have been a planner in Saldanha a couple of years ago. But these are some of the aquaculture activities in the bay. And they are already much larger than they were when I lived there. But if we just take a look at this picture, which, and I think this whole Saldanha Bay scenario is a microcosm of what this whole act is about. If you look at the blocks there, that does indicate different places where aquaculture is practiced. It shows the pier. It also shows the LPG, where ships are supposed to moor and offload gas. That has a landward effect. Where will that gas be stored and so forth? So it all is a contested space. Who gives out those licenses? Who determines where that is? And all those competing things. So, and all of that has a landward implication, especially for municipalities such as Saldanha. So the Marine Spatial Bill, although it may be focused more outward, further from land, in certain areas it has a very definite connection and impact on the land-based operations. Then there's the Coastal Management Act, which was also mentioned before, but an interesting thing in the Coastal Management Act is that it calls for coastal planning schemes. And that's not only for the local authority, it calls for national government as well as provincial government to have such schemes. And it appears to me that this bill does not seem to recognize this or its potential conflicts, and most importantly, the interface between the bill and this act. So it does not provide the user with a logical point of entry in the important task of integrating terrestrial and marine spatial planning. Okay, I'm not going to repeat that. That is just suggestions there. Having said that, about the integration, we have noticed that there are working groups, national working groups suggested, there's a director general committee, and there's a ministerial committee. But in none of those we see representation from provincial officials or from municipal officials, and on the ministerial committee, the MEC representation. And all of this speaks to me to a lack of integrated planning on the side of the IDP and municipal spatial planning. Procedures for committees. In clause 10.7a, we just saw that the Directors General Committee approve or refer to a ministerial committee. That we find a bit odd. You either approve or you're an approving body, or you're a commenting body and you would refer a comment. And then in clause 11.6a, it refers to sixes in itself, so we believe that should have been seven. Then there are two pages of some smaller technical things. I'm really not going to labour you with that. It's in our comments. It could assist in improved drafting. And yes, in summation, I would just want to say that the bill may have significant implication for provinces and municipalities that have a coastline. The terrestrial areas adjacent to the ocean will be directly affected by the marine spatial planning. Provincial governments and municipalities will have to be prepared and respond to the marine spatial planning system. And that one will only be able to do if there's proper representation and proper integrated planning. And that is it from my side. Thank you, Mr. Chair, honourable members.
Okay, thanks. Thanks a lot. That was pointed as well. May we receive, in terms of the program, the last presentation from Mr. Colin Brenda, City of Cape Town.
Honourable Chair, Honourable Members and Guests. These are not all my presentations, so don't worry. I have come a little bit unprepared, and I do not have a presentation. So I'll just speak from some notes that I've made. I'm representing the City of Cape Town as the Head of Coastal Policy and Management Programs. The need for a marine spatial planning bill is clearly evident from what the various speakers have said. So from that perspective, it is incredibly important given the emerging priorities surrounding ocean governance. From the City of Cape Town side, and I'm wearing a local government hat in terms of these comments that I do have, one of the main intents of the MSP bill is that it will, and I quote, provide institutional arrangements for implementation of marine plans, governance of the use of the ocean by multiple sectors. The emphasis there is on governance in that key objective. So from our perspective, as a local government, we consider governance fairly broadly, and that it is basically the whole of public as well as private interactions taken to solve social problems and create social or societal opportunities. And that is, of course, the key drive behind Operation Pakisa as well as the Marine Spatial Planning Bill. So governance in this respect should include, amongst others, negotiation and engagement between all three tiers of governments, national, provincial, local, civil society, as well as including the private sector. In this instance, it is key because the interventions, rules, regulations, strategies, and marine area plans that emanate from the Marine Spatial Planning Bill will have direct and indirect implications for local government, particularly as it relates to activities that may be scheduled in the near shore. And for this reason, we feel that local government, as well as other sectors at a lower level, need to be included in this process of developing issues or strategies that are linked to the MSP bill, which include the area plans and whatnot. However, obviously we feel that's quite important, but in terms of the Marine Spatial Planning Bill, there is no institutional mechanism that I can see that would facilitate communication and collaboration between national governments and governments at the local level. And I think that's an important link, as I said, because the Marine Spatial Planning Bill and activities and the regulations surrounding that will have a direct impact on local government. It does make reference to institutional arrangements such as the National Working Group, the Ministerial Committee, and the Director General Committee. The National Working Group makes reference to a whole bunch of responsibilities and points, i.e. Makes reference to mapping and maps and spatial data of different sector uses, compatible and incompatible uses with specific ocean planning, synergies among compatible users, etc. Those have direct relevance and value to local government, and hence the call for some sort of institutional or clarity around some sort of institutional arrangement that would facilitate communication between local governments and higher tiers of government in the development of the MSP, but more relevantly in the development of local area plans related to that. And that is effectively the comment from the City of Cape Town representing local governments.
Thanks a lot.
It is, that is in writing.
Okay. Thanks a lot. We do have that submission. Let me verify or check if there's any other stakeholder who is not in the program, who may be part of us. I know that Fish SA have given an apology. They can't make it to this meeting, but we have their submission, as well as the University of KZN. Professor D. Glansom can make this meeting. So may I just check whether we're leaving any other stakeholder outside? Not. Okay. Thanks a lot. We have come to the end of presentations, therefore, and we have had all the inputs that were given. As I said at some point, that there are those issues that perhaps need to be responded to by the department right away, where there may be clarity or some conceptualization in terms of what will happen as and when this bill, once its law is implemented. So those will expect the department once more to come and respond, even before we do that submission to conclude this particular public hearing session. Particularly issues that would relate to the linkages or roles of other planners, particularly from local government or those who are not necessarily in the marine space but are engaged with activities that support the marine activities. Those in terrestrial environments or outside of the waters, the main one that responded to, and the institutional mechanism that seems to be a worry to most stakeholders in terms of how they will participate going forward, because they think they're going to be left out, and the conflicting issues, how they will be regulated or how that will be reconciled as and when some of them may want to bully others in the process. What happens? What sort of consensus will be generated or how will that be generated? May I therefore invite the Chief Director once more to just respond to those that you noted which you think are worth clarifying. But of course, let me assure this public hearing platform that once we have developed our own report, we would invite the department to answer to some of those questions that we got throughout the public hearing, so that we are aware how they would handle them, and where we think various stakeholders had a case, we'll consider that favorably and then have them included in the final product of this particular bill, which will then get to be an act. Over to you, sir.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you to all the members who provided input. I think I'll start from the presentation from the Center for Environmental Rights. It was quite encouraging, getting such specific inputs on the bill. if you recall, Mr. Rooks was once a member of the National Working Group, and he has himself noted today that there has been quite a lot of improvement that has been done. Chair, we had a stakeholder summit on the MSP bill and the MSP framework, and all inputs that were given have been reflected in this specific bill as it is now. And the publication we had on the draft MSP bill was for public comments was for 60 days, specifically just to incorporate everyone's comment. But what we would note, Chair, is that in this next phase of marine area planning, we as a department will probably would need to, since the real planning is going to start now, to include a lot more stakeholders. And we do encourage any other stakeholders that might feel left out to be part of the process. And then what came up very strongly, Chair, today is that the role of civil society is very important, and the suggestions have been made that maybe in the structures that are presented in the bill, this should be in the form of a forum, and that the department does note, and as we go forward, Chair, we will respond to each and every input that has been made. And then the information base, I think, is critical that we continue basing our bill on information from the different sectors and stakeholders. Because if we do lack information in certain areas, the precautionary approach that we did include in some of the principles in the bill is very important. So that we do note. And also, Professor Kindley did make mention of the fact that some definitions we might need to relook, and the department, we will pay attention to some of the inputs which were made today. And then what came out clearly was the clarity between the ICM Act, which is the Integrated Coastal Management Act, and the Marine Special Planning Bill. I have two colleagues here who are lawyers from the department. Maybe they might want to touch on that, but from my understanding, these two acts, Chair, they are regulating two different things. The ICM Act, there is a closer link between the people and the coast. But as you go offshore in the ocean environment, you would need a vessel. You can't walk into the ocean, and hence the biophysical issues of the Act, and also the what the Act seeks to do is not the same as the ICM Act, but I think the integration and the clarity around what the two acts are seeking to do is maybe something that we would need in our responses to the inputs which we made. And then the land and oceans linkages. In the National Working Group, we have the department called Rural Development and Land Reform, which are actually responsible for planning. And that specifically was designed as per the ministerial decision, which was taken in 2013, to have them included because they have experience in planning. And we, in the ocean, we are learning as much as we can from them. But the only difference between the ocean chairs, as you are aware, is that there are no structures in the oceans. There's no houses in the streets in the ocean. And then there's planning on land, which seeks to have arrangements different from what we seek to do in the ocean. And on land, we have houses, we have streets, we have fields, we have all sorts of things. But in the ocean, we might have activities which are not necessarily the same. But then the planning principles are the same, whether you're planning for land or the ocean, but then the differences might appear there. But we have learned a lot from the Spluma Act that is being used on land. And then the inclusion of estuaries, I think this was mentioned, and is something that we would have to look at how best we could include the stakeholders who are responsible for that. But I'll give over to Advocate Nikita Gok to just make the final comments. Thank you.
Thank you, Chairperson. I'm just going to cover the aspects that my colleague raised in regards to the differences between the ICM Act and this bill. There's been a couple of comments raised that this MSP bill can't exist without an oceans bill framework. I'd just like to mention that a National Environmental Management Oceans Bill, or an act, is really a piece of sector environmental legislation. So the MSP bill is a national cooperation, it's a piece of cooperative governance legislation that crosses all sectors. It's not purely an environmental piece of legislation, whereas an oceans bill would be an environmental piece of legislation. The fact that we don't have one does, of course, not mean that there isn't laws that relate to the ocean. In all of our national environmental legislation, whether it's NEMA or the Biodiversity Act or the ICM Act or the Protected Areas Act, we have many, many laws that cover the marine environment, including marine species, marine protected areas, etc. So an oceans bill would really take a lot of those sections and just consolidate it into one act, which is not necessarily required when there are laws in place already. And as far as ICM goes, ICM is a dynamic environment. It's the land-sea interface, and so has created a very specific framework to deal with the three spheres of government that do manage that space. MSP is something quite different from that. As my colleague indicated, it deals with a huge ocean space where there are quite often less role players, and it's more about planning in that space using sector legislation like ICM Act, like the Marine Living Resources Act, which deals with fishing, like the MPRDA, which deals with mining. So all of those sector legislation will apply and will be utilized to do the planning in that space. So this bill needs to be looked at as a framework legislation for planning, but still allowing each department to manage its sector in line with its own legislation. Thank you.
Okay, thanks, Advocate. Let me assure all stakeholders or various persons who made inputs today that we have taken your presentations seriously. Even as some of them might have slightly gone outside the bill itself, but perhaps you were so passionate about those issues you raised, and we did understand the message. Particularly even if one was to refer to the first input, it was largely to tell us that we must be able to be very scientific and broad in our own thinking as we take to heart this particular bill, and not necessarily speaking to the aspects of the bill itself. But I think as members we understood the message. Other inputs, for instance, from the divers, there was some quotation there in your input in Afrikaans that said, Jelle Bieteken next, and so on. And so on. That's not our attitude. Once you have got no political mark, that's not our attitude. Whoever might have said that, to us, you are valuable, you are meaningful. Whatever input you made, even as largely it related to mineral resources and so on, we have had the message, we'll see how we interact with them and ensure that to some degree you are assisted. We may not understand how you raised your other presentations, to what extent were they relevant to what was happening, why you might not have been attended to, and so on and so on. We don't want to get into that space, but we have had all your concerns that you shared with us this morning. The border issues as well are issues that will be handled elsewhere, and not necessarily within environmental affairs, but you did fill us up in terms of what you understood to be the issues. And just to thank everybody who made the inputs, from the universities to the Western Cape province to the city of Cape Town, everybody who has made those particular inputs. Some of the inputs, we have them in writing. You might not have presented them fully because you focused on your power presentations and so on, but we'll take it upon ourselves to go through everything that you presented, so that by the time we finalize, we have a broader understanding of what you wanted us to get. Members, I take it I'm not suppressing you. If we don't take any hands from yourselves, you will be fine. Let me thank all of you, members present, departmental officials, parliamentary officials, various stakeholders who made these input or submissions, and wishing you safe travel back to your various destinations. Hope we'll interact again in the future. Thanks a lot. This parliament public hearing is adjourned.